This is Wade Rathke with the Chief Organizer's Report on remembering the injustice that lies in Indian Country. While in the trailer last week, I finished the recent volume by Timothy Egan, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, the epic life and immortal photographs of Edward Curtis. Then, by happenstance, my friends at BCGEU in Canada had given me a copy of the recently published The Inconvenient Indian, a curious account of Native people in North America by Thomas King. And by some magical coincidence that seems to lie somewhere between fate and destiny, my daughter Danae gave me a commemorative photo album of Polaroid pictures of the Rock Creek Rendezvous, whose cover was a 1905 picture, Entering the Badlands, by, of course, Edward Curtis. Not sure what all that means, but I'm smart enough to realize at this point it's a sign of something, and I should just go with it. Though the books were as different as night and day in many ways, Indian Country might be seen as their common thread running between them. Curtis, for over a century, has been recognized as one of the magisterial photographers of Indians across North America. Egan's framework was riches-to-rags story of an obsession that consumed Curtis's life and career as he sought to record in 20 volumes the past and sometimes the present of tribes and bands of Native Americans and First Canadians across North America. His signal accomplishment over decades was the completion of this 20-volume photographic and anthropological tour de force on Indians throughout the continent. Egan paints a picture of both success and lack of appreciation for the task from institutions throughout the country. Much of Curtis's field work was finally underwritten by the legendary cutthroat financier J.P. Morgan during a time of Morgan's late career and retirement that Egan describes as largely consisting of collecting art and mistresses across several continents. Before one can finally say that at least there's one good thing Morgan did in his life, it seems that as soon as he died, though his family begrudgingly continued to fund Curtis's fieldwork, they valued it so little that they sold all 20,000 original plates of his work to a dealer for $1,000 in the Great Depression just to be rid of it all. Each full set is now valued at between $2 and $3 million apiece. If Egan's book is largely designed to resurrect the reputation of a man unappreciated in his own time, King's Inconvenient Indian is a book that reads like a clever, barbed, incisive, and comprehensive indictment of an entire people unappreciated in all of the times since Europeans set foot on North American soil. And of course, unappreciated does not remotely express the genocide, oppression, double-dealing, and downright hate and exploitation has greeted the Native population in the U.S. and Canada for the last number of centuries. You might think you've heard all of this before, and what new is there to be said? Well, yes and no. But in King's hands, the skilled organization of this relatively short book and his cheeky, witty telling of horrible stories of injustice is devastatingly effective in a one-volume refresher course that would surely punctuate any impression that some booming casinos and benign neglect had somehow solved the problems of justice for the Native peoples. Reading the book together makes Egan's book on Curtis pale by comparison. In King's hands, Curtis is involved in cowboy and Indian, or what he calls dead Indian, myth-making. And though Egan briefly acknowledges that Curtis rarely lifted a finger in advocating for justice for Native peoples, other than telling and photographing their story, or at least a version of their story, The Inconvenient Indian, by contrast, would essentially shrug at the fact that Curtis was not heralded for his work, his epic work, as guilt by association at worst and par for the course at best. Curtis' work simply as art might stand taller if it were not so clear from Egan's book that art operates here as a plaything for the rich, since any that would hold Curtis's work as a public good would have to value the lives and aspirations of Native peoples as a primary interest. King reminds us that no one cares, and justice is still something sought without success. King ends with some high notes and looking at the deals made for a separate Inuit area in Canada and the Alaskan Native corporations, but that's another trick up his sleeve, since there are scores of examples from our times that he offered earlier, making it clear that these problems are evergreen and still waiting for justice. This is Wade Rathke for questions or comments, www.chieforganizer.org. You take it from here to there.